Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where the three of us, three average Joes, attempt to tackle the significant questions in movie culture. And my name is Justin, and I'm joined here by...
Alex.
And Noah.
Hello, gentlemen. Well, we have... this is the second episode in the new format for Cinema Joes. Last time we talked about Beauty and the Beast and the trend of Disney live-action remakes. And on this show, we try to talk about a bigger topic that coincides with the recent release. And what we'll be doing this episode is talking about Your Name, the latest film from Makoto Shinkai. And we'll also be talking about sort of this comparison that's been made between him and Hayao Miyazaki, one that he has roundly rejected, seemingly, and appears to be quite a big fan of Miyazaki. But before we get into that, I thought we'd maybe just start off like we do by talking about what's the last thing that we watched that was not Your Name. Alex, do you want to go first?
I've been watching Big Little Lies, which is an HBO miniseries on that just wrapped up this past Sunday that we're recording. It is all of the episodes were directed by Jean-Marc Rolet, who's a director who I have mixed feelings about. I liked some of his films and I hated some of his films. So, but I generally like his style. It's a very cinematic show. It has great acting performances by Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman, primarily also Laura Dern and Zoe Kravitz and Shailene Woodley round out the cast of women. It's a very female-focused show. Also has Alexander Skarsgård and Adam Scott as two of the husbands involved. I'm sure a lot of people know this show by now, but so I won't get too far into what it is or what it's about, but what I really like about it is just that it's giving us this opportunity to see these really complicated, multifaceted female characters be explored in a long-form way that is just not happening very much in film these days. And I think it shows what the television medium is really great about right now. Also happening in a similar vein, but in a very different style, is Ryan Murphy's feud on FX with leading ladies from the silver screen, like Jessica Lange and Susan Sarandon playing Bette Davis and Joan Crawford as they were making Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Another great short form miniseries diving into the lives of middle-aged women in a way that we've been able to see countless shows and movies over the last few decades about the lives of middle-aged men. And so I think it's really exciting that television is making up for something that the cinema has been lacking lately in this regard.
Cool. Yeah, I've heard about both the shows, but I don't know when I'm ever going to, if I'm ever going to see them, unfortunately.
They're both really easy watches. They're the type of things that if you have a free Sunday, you could probably plow through all of the episodes. The Big Little Lies is only 7 episodes long, and Feud is only 8 episodes long. Feud is still running right now. It'll be finished in about 2 weeks. So they're really easy to get through. They're just a little bit longer than a pretty long movie. So it's really worth checking out just to get different types of stories out there. And if you're a film buff, I think that checking out Feud is even better because you get to see all these like interesting behind the scenes nitty-gritty about the way that films were made back then. And also it's a huge supporting cast filled with stars as well, like Alfred Molina and Stanley Tucci giving great supporting performances.
Yeah, it's funny, when I saw the trailer for Feud or the promotional material, I just thought like, hey, it's like a live action version of You Must Remember This, the podcast by Karina Longworth, where she talks about, you know, sort of the behind the scenes stories of things like the rivalry between Bette Davis and Joan Crawford. So I was like, oh, that's cool. Someone's actually, you know, doing something about this. And I got very talented actresses to do it. So how about you, Noah? What's the last thing you watched?
The most recent thing that I've been getting into is Stella and I have been tearing through a bit of an older show, a German show from about 10 years ago called Turkish for Beginners, which is, and anyone who's lived or traveled through Germany knows that there's a very, very large Turkish population or people of partially Turkish descent in Germany. So it's sort of a family drama mixed with a sort of a clash of culture story. It's about a single German mother with two children who gets together with and eventually gets married to a single Turkish man and his two children and all the crazy hijinks that ensue. It's mostly a romantic comedy, but it's very much, its tone is very much, I don't know if either of you remember Ned's Declassified.
Vague memories.
That you are missing out, because it is an amazing show. It's very much in that vein of being incredibly, like, incredibly tongue-in-cheek, and deliberately very, how can I say this, almost like sort of trashy in its style. Like, they'll have really, like, really weird jokes or really out-there stretches for a gag, or a lot of, like, weird sight gags, and the characters overact, really overact sometimes in bizarre ways. But it worked for Ned's Declassified, and it works for this show as well, so we're having a good time watching that. Also, it's fun to see a movie about, like, you know, teenagers coming of age 10 years ago, and noting just the technology differences between then and now. Like, when all the teenagers start taking out their cell phones, and I'm like, whoa, wow, that takes me back. So yeah, so that's the, I have not been able to see any good movies recently, but tomorrow we're going to go see a new German movie called Tiger Girl, and the trailer was very intriguing, but I can't begin to say that I have any idea what it's about. It just looks very intriguing, and although the German movie industry is small, the past couple years have featured a couple of really, really, really good films that have come out, stuff like Phoenix or Labyrinth of Silence, or The Nightmare, which was on my top 10 list for last year. So not a lot by international standards, but for each of the past couple of years, there's been one or two really, really good or interesting German films. Oh, Victoria is another one that I forgot to mention. So, like, a German film that really is something different or new or challenging. So I'm very much hoping that this year continues that trend. So I'm looking forward to seeing what I think of Tiger Girl. Cool. And I'll probably be reviewing it for my site.
Oh, great.
We should probably add at this point, for our listeners who don't know, Noah lives in Germany now.
That's probably helpful.
He's from America, but he's living in Germany at the moment. That's why there's so much German content on his side.
This is true. Yes.
Well, cool. And for myself, I finally got around to watching Doctor Strange. I had a lot of fun with it. I don't think...
That's good. I'm glad that you've seen it, Justin, because I've come to bargain.
I definitely feel like it's not as good as some of Marvel's other output lately, namely something from last year as well, like Captain America Civil War, which we talked about. But I did really like that this was, like, such a new setting for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I really was a fan of the M.C. Escher-inspired action sequences. The only other movie I can think of that's really done that would be maybe Inception. And I love how they play.
This is like Inception on steroids, though.
Yeah, I mean, they're altering gravity and the laws of physics. You know, buildings are, like, assuming new forms. It's really, like, it's really out there.
The world literally transforms into blocks in midair.
I will say that I wasn't... My sort of concerns about the whitewashing controversy were not necessarily assuaged by watching this film, considering that the sort of magical world that Doctor Strange finds himself in seems very inspired by Eastern religion and philosophy. and pretty much any Asian characters are all on the sideline in this film.
Yeah, you get a whole scene of the Asian characters who occupy the Hong Kong barrier suiting up and arming up for battle, and they all die off screen.
I mean,
but they look really cool right before they get cut, before the film cuts away from them.
Which is a shame, because the one guy, I'm blanking on his name. He's been in a lot of
Benedict
stuff.
Benedict Wong?
He was really good. Like, he was a good character.
He has some of the funniest moments in the film, honestly.
Well, and do you guys know who he, like, what that character is in the comics? Because they really did a lot to help him out. He plays Doctor Strange's manservant, who comes from a long line of being the Sorcerer Supreme's manservant. So that's his whole thing, is that, like, he gets, like, if you get the title of Sorcerer Supreme, you get Wong as your servant. So in that respect, I think that they did a lot to make it a lot more acceptable to modern audiences.
Yeah.
It was something I was very aware of. And to be fair, I think a lot of this is more like sort of the way that Westerners have perceived a lot of these things. I mean, like, this is drawn from the comic. It's not necessarily, I think really trying to draw from Buddhism or Taoism or other religions. But it did make me very aware. I was like, wow, this seems very inspired by like the fact that the school is in Nepal, and they talk about these books of magic that are written in Sanskrit, and yet the teacher is white, and the new Sorcerer Supreme is also white. It was just something I was very aware of as I was watching it, and
But Justin, she's Celtic, so it's okay.
Not white.
Which was funny, because I was expecting it to be more Celtic inspired, and then I saw it really wasn't. I was like, well, yeah, this is where the problem was, guys. But in any case, I don't want to belabor that, but I did
she's
really
Irish,
like
Justin. She's not white. She's red.
I mean, she's Tilda Swinton. She's kind of outside any sort of earthly human, I think. I did
that was
also
a John
like
Oliver that was a John Oliver joke of last week tonight.
Oh, was it?
Like, really? when aliens come to Earth, our first question should be, what was Tilda Swinton like as a child?
But I did like this sort of concept about the film that runs through it, about sort of what it takes to do good and the sacrifices that you have to make, and also the toll that takes on you. There's this whole device of, turning back time, which anytime he did it, the song "If I Could Turn Back Time" just ran through my head.
I wish they had played that instead of that Beyonce song.
You do actually see, like, kind of, and also this movie has one of the most unexpectedly hilarious climaxes to a Marvel film that I've seen, when he sort of faces this dark spirit. That's threatening to
Dormammu,
destroy the world.
You mean
Dormammu? Yes,
can't forget that name.
I kind of loved that whole sequence. But so overall, I really enjoyed it. I don't know if I would say that. I don't know if it's as strong as some of Marvel's other output, but I was glad to see it. So, other than that, so I guess we can move on to our main event. And perhaps we'll just start by talking generally about Your Name. This is a film that I know, Alex, you and I both saw yesterday.
Yes.
It's so much fresh in our heads. I know, Noah, I don't think you've seen this one yet. But
not yet.
Did you want to start, Alex, by just sharing some general thoughts, and maybe I'll add some of my own?
Okay, sure, because I think I liked it a little bit more than you did, so I'll praise it effusively, and then you can tell me why I'm wrong. So I loved this movie. I was very surprised. It really snuck up on me. For the first maybe half hour, I was wondering what all the fuss was about. It seemed like a pretty nice small story about like a boy and a girl who are roughly the same age, and they get they have to swap bodies, and you know, they drew a lot of humor from it, and it was pretty low stakes, and it was just pleasant. It was a pleasant experience. But then all of a sudden, like, the second half of the movie comes and it really kicks into this other gear that's a lot more emotionally rich and vibrant and visually spectacular. I found it very, very impressive overall. I thought some of the imagery is just gorgeous in the movie. And the performances were good. I saw the English dubbed performance. I wanted to see the sub performance, the sub version of the film, but I just couldn't get into it. The screen times didn't work out. But the performances that were there, I thought were good. I'd like to know what the original Japanese actors did with those roles, though. But anyway, I found it a really compelling story. They broke down the basic kind of what would a teenage boy and a teenage girl in these types of situations. And they, like I said, they drew some interesting humor from it and a lot of interesting emotional angles. And they just executed that premise very, very well and allowed it to kind of spiral into this other more emotional story that I found very engaging. And it was paired with some very evocative, beautiful images. So, yeah, I'm very much all for Your Name.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely agree with you, especially about the imagery. And I think overall I did like it, though. I did have a harder time really connecting with these characters for some reason. And I was definitely what you're saying about, like, the first half hour, where I had sort of a similar thought where I was like, okay, where is this going? There's a lot of sort of, like, wacky hijinks, which was very jarring for me because of what I've seen of Shinkai's work, which, to be fair, is not a lot. I've seen two of his early short films, Other Worlds and She and Her Cat, as well as 5 Centimeters Per Second, which is a very quiet and sort of meditative film. And, like, I would say all of these movies are sort of more, like, very intimate, but also sort of, like, quietly profound, and sort of, like, nag at you a little bit with something. And like, kind of the experience you were talking about, Alex, of it kind of sneaking up on you. And watching, like, the first half hour of this movie, I was like, I almost felt like I was watching the work of a different director or something. There's a lot of sort of, like, wacky hijinks, a lot of, like, musical montages, and it was very jarring experience for me.
I really liked that musical montage, though. I thought that it was executed so well. They brought out, it let them really dive into what the practical everyday aspects of this type of ridiculous scenario would be like without having to actually devote a lot of screen time to it. I thought that was a very ingenious way of handling it.
Yeah, I don't mean to say that I didn't like them necessarily. I guess what I'm trying to say was such a shift from what I had known of this director.
Right. I should say I have no background with the director, and I'm actually a little bit of an anime newbie. This is only a second
Neophyte.
Anime.
Neophyte.
Yes,
we use the
Neophyte.
Politically correct term.
Okay. I'm a noob, as they would say on the boards.
Neophyte still sounds like condescending, unfortunately.
It feels very condescending.
which is not how we think of you at all.
Are you an awoke or not?
But I was, like, very sort of taken by the various tonal shifts that this movie takes. There's, especially because the first part of it is so kind of light, you know, and sort of, I think, touches upon a lot of, you know, body switching movies of which I can't
touches
think of
upon
a ton.
Is a touches
yeah,
upon
maybe
is
not.
A good choice of words.
Yeah. Totally.
If you've seen the movie, you know why that's
yes.
a funny joke.
Compared to the rest of his body of work.
Oh man.
Puns.
But anyway, getting back to it, I do like that the second half of this sort of launches into more of a mystery, and you start to see how these two characters are connected in more ways than just, you know, by having this odd thing happen to them. And I guess to me it was just like I found it. I found some of the. I found the two characters like not as immediately compelling as some of you know, say the main characters in 5 centimeters per second. I think that might be more due to the fact that you know, these are two characters who sort of occupy a different space than those characters did. I mean, in 5 centimeters per second, you had these two characters who are very much outcasts and misfits, and I see these two people as being more, you know, still sort of unsure of themselves, but also maybe more immediately connected. Like they seem to have, you know, relationships with other people their age, and but I guess that was something that I had to sort of adjust to. And I don't know if I was, I guess I wanted to be more compelled by, something that happens later on, which I guess I can't get into if we're trying to avoid spoilers. But there's a sequence in this where there's sort of like, time is running out and they need to, solve something. And, I just never really felt the weight of that I wanted to.
Really?
Yeah.
See, all of that stuff worked for me. I felt very engaged by Mitsuha and Taki right away. I feel like they're what you lack with them being kind of outsiders, like you're talking about. Like they're not that, but they are in this very extreme and disorienting situation. And I feel like, and it's a very private situation that they can't really share with anyone else because who would believe them if they did? So I think that immediately otherizes them and makes them feel almost like they have this kind of connection with the audience, because the audience is the only thing observing this phenomena going on. So for me, that was my way into the characters. I felt very connected to them, especially as the movie went on. And I also think that the filmmaking did help in that, because I was one of the things that I was surprised by, and this may just be because I'm used to American animated films where there's not a lot of quiet and there's not a lot of room to breathe, and it's very plot-based in a lot of ways. Even Pixar movies have a lot of stuff moving and going on in the backgrounds to try to keep everyone's attention at all times. This movie really had a lot of quiet moments early on establishing the characters, I thought. Like, there was this one moment where Mitsuha is just walking down the steps alone thinking about something, and there's no background music playing, and there's no kind of frantic energy behind it in any way. She's just kind of absorbing what's just happened and is trying to kind of get her bearings and figure out what's going on, and you're just with her in this quiet moment. And I was honestly shocked by that, because that's something that I just don't associate happening in an animated film.
That is much more characteristic of Japanese animation and of Japanese films in general, that scenes will go on longer than someone with a more Western perspective would expect or would do. And there'll be a lot of scenes that won't necessarily have a plot purpose. They'll simply be there to create atmosphere.
Right, and that's...
And you see that in Japanese live action and in Japanese anime. But it's more... The difference in anime is more stark, because you really don't see that in Western animation at all. Like, regardless of story or genre or what have you.
Well, and I think a lot of Western live action films could benefit from that, and they often don't. They often don't take that extra beat to kind of have a small character moment. And I always value that, because I think that helps you connect to your protagonist so strongly. So those little moments are things that I really appreciated early on. And then I think that they pay off, because they lay a solid emotional foundation for what comes next.
Yeah, and I felt like, I don't know if you felt this way, Alex, but I felt like a lot of the more sort of grand emotional moments were so underlined that I felt like I was sort of being, you know, taken by the hand and said, like, here, this is, you know, here's what you're supposed to feel. Here's where you're supposed to feel, you know, the emotion and what everything's been building up to.
I think you can't forget that this is a movie about teenagers, so I kind of wrote that I like that type of excessive emotion in certain points, or that one could say is a bit manipulative or a bit hand-holding, for me just felt very true and authentic to the characters. Like, these are 14 and 17-year-olds, I believe, in the film. Somewhere around then, maybe 13 and 16.
I thought they were supposed to be... Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. But,
no, in any case, they're both teenagers, right? And I think that as teenagers, emotions tend to be heightened. So I think that if the film expresses that, it's authentic to the characters. So it never really bothered me.
Yeah, it's not. I don't, but it's not like the kind of like self-aware sort of moments of that. I don't know. It didn't really get to that. I guess it didn't get to that point for me.
Yeah, I feel like the film is a very empathetic film towards its characters. It really takes on the emotional reality of its characters and is able to shift in tone and a lot because of that. But because I felt really engaged with the characters, I felt I didn't have any issues with that.
Yeah, and I guess that really was sort of what I think is keeping me sort of ambivalent about the film, is that I just did have that sort of disconnect from the characters throughout this. That's, you know, and it could be that maybe I just need to either like see it again or think about it more, because I really, you know, I haven't really like sat down and thought about this.
Which version did you see, the dubbed version as well?
But so I saw the subtitled version. They actually were playing that one, yeah. I mean, they were playing both, but at different times. And I was like, oh, I'd rather go see the subtitle one, because I don't know. I find dubbed versions tend to take me out of, well, anything, but anime specifically. So, yeah, and I guess, I don't know, like, I was also like, there's this other thing that he does in the movie, where there are sort of musical, I don't know if I'd call them interludes. They're more like just moments where all of a sudden we get a pop tune coinciding with the events of the plot. And that was always, to me, it was always like very jarring. And sort of, I felt like I felt like it took me out of the immediacy of the moment. But I don't know. How did you feel about that, Alex?
That was never really about bother for me. I kind of wish that the song was maybe a little bit better, but it didn't distract for me at all. Definitely I wasn't necessarily expecting it, but it feels in keeping with the type of film that they're making. You know, they're making a body swapping movie about teenagers, not just for teenagers, but clearly I feel like that is kind of the demographic that it's most appealing to. And those types of films tend to have pop songs in them to help score their climax, you know? So it didn't really bother me so much. It didn't feel any more intrusive than any other kind of film. I'm trying to think of a comparison. I know, like, The Edge of 17 is a similar movie for me. I think that movie, the character has a bit more depth to it than the characters here, but it feels like a very similar type of tone, where it kind of shifts from, there's moments of kind of wackiness and there's moments of kind of high anxiety and we need to do the thing or something bad's gonna happen and my life is gonna be over because the stakes are so high because I'm a teenager. But then there's also a really strong emotional component to it, where you realize that there's more going on to these characters and than just the kind of superficiality of teenage life.
Right. And I'm curious, were the songs in Japanese for you, or were they in English?
They were in English for me. They were in Japanese for you.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So they were in Japanese, but with a translation.
Okay. So, yeah, I could see how that could be even more distracting. Yeah.
But, yeah, so I guess, yeah, so those are, I guess, our general thoughts, and I want to kind of bring you into this, Noah. Perhaps we could talk about the comparisons that have been made between Shinkai and Miyazaki, who I think many
Oh,
go ahead.
sorry, just before we move on to that, I just want to say, I just want to say again how gorgeous the visuals are in this film. They do this really. I'm pretty sure they're blending a little bit of CG into the hand-drawn animation in order to get this effect of the comet that comes, or which is a key plot point in the film. You know that there's a comet that's on display throughout the majority of the film, and it is so gorgeous to look at, and the way that it looks in the film is just, I mean, you could see a little bit of it in some of the trailers and promotional materials for the film, but seeing it in context and extended throughout the scene,
I expect nothing less from Shinkai, because his the visuals in his films are extremely colorful and extremely detailed. There's one particular shot, I actually just recently rewatched 5 cm/s. There's sort of a subplot where at one point one of the characters is living near a launch pad or a launch field for space rockets, and there's a scene where, you know, this one rocket is sent up, and he and a character are having a scene together, and they just sort of stop and watch this rocket go up, and you get like this cutaway shot from space of the rocket going up into outer space, and of course leaving the plume of, you know, fuel and exhaust behind it. And you see like the angle they deliberately do the shot at, you see like the streaming sunlight coming from the direction where the sun is as the rocket is going up, and as it gets higher and leaves this plume, the plume casts a shadow over the entire half of the Earth beneath it. Like, that sort of acute, precise detail is something that he does in all of his films. So I'm in no way, I would be shocked if you were both saying, oh, the visuals weren't that fantastic in this movie. That would be more shocking to me.
Yeah, I found them spectacular. I would honestly, if you just put the film, as emotionally invested as I was in the movie, if you just put it on mute and I could just watch the visuals for an hour and a half, I would be just as happy.
Yeah, there's one shot in this, I guess there's no camera. But there's one image in this movie where we see sort of the thread, like this thread actually turn into the tail of a comet. And it's really spectacular to behold. And I don't want to say more than that for Noah. there's no doubt to me that these animations and I think his films in general are real labors of love. There really is a way in which these images feel like they're treasured by their creator. So let's talk about, I guess we'll talk about the comparisons, like I said, between Shinkai and Miyazaki. And it's funny, I was just in doing a little bit of research on this question, I'm amazed at how many different outlets have at least posed this question to Shinkai, to a point where I wonder if he's really getting sick of it. And I think he has, there's more than a few interviews, including when he was just starting out, like when he had released his first feature film, which I think was The Place Promised in Our Early Days, to the release of this film, he keeps getting this question about, you know, what do you think about being called the next Miyazaki? And every time he's been very sort of like dismissive of this claim. He thinks he isn't in that league. There was one of the interviews that he did with Active Anime back in 2005. They asked him, "You've been referred to as the new Miyazaki. What are your thoughts on that?" He said, "It's an honor to hear, but I think the comparison is an overestimation. I'm very influenced by Hayao Miyazaki, but his works have an incomparable richness that is not the same animation as my animation. I certainly won't create such wonderful works in my future. However, I would like to deliver works that have a different place with audiences than the place of Hayao Miyazaki's films." And I wanted to kind of maybe get your opinion on that, and maybe, Noah, you could especially speak to this, because I know you and I have seen all of Miyazaki's feature films. Do you agree with that statement? Do you think they do occupy a different place? And if that's the case, what place do Miyazaki's films occupy, and what place do Shinkai's films occupy?
That's a very Yeah, that's...
It's a big question.
Also, it's a question that really depends on the individual, because the quote-unquote, and I'm doing air quotes when I say this, the place film or films hold in people's hearts are very much dependent on the individual. So I would say, well, first off, on a visual level, there is a clear difference, because Miyazaki and Ghibli films in general tend to have more of a softer feel to them, with rounder shapes, and there are more clear, harder edges to Shinkai's films. At least I haven't seen everything he's done, but there's more of a sharpness to his animation and his style. And in terms of content, he seems to be, well, at the very least, 5 centimeters per second and In the Garden of Words, which are the two films of his I have seen, they take place in cities. So there is more of an urban setting, or at least in part. There's more of an urban or human-focused center to his settings, whereas Miyazaki is more often drawn to nature or where... The human scenes are not as much the focus of the film. And they're also he also seems to have more of a trend of focusing on two or a small number of characters who are in some ways loners or set apart from everyone else and how that affects them. Because 5 centimeters per second, there are two main characters and then a third somewhat main character that are all just a little bit different, and there are these themes of loss, of isolation, maybe of depression. And in The Garden of Words, there's really only two characters in that film, and that also deals with these two characters find each other and how they try to process how they're different from the people around them. And it seems to me, based on what I know of the premise of this movie, that this is similar. You have two characters who, obviously in this case, through rather remarkable circumstances, are set apart. And from what I understand, most of the film is them struggling to come to terms with that. And so that, at least in terms of the types of stories he seems to tell, there definitely strikes me as this very particular type of story that he likes to do that is much more different from the different types of nature and fantasy focused stories that Miyazaki does. But in terms of the place it holds in people's hearts, yeah, that's just that, like, I think every person individually has to answer that for themselves, you know? And it's sort of like Ghibli, yeah, 'cause... Ghibli as a whole has been around so long, it has a niche that any director who tries to do that type of movie is just going to be, oh, well, you're doing what Ghibli does. You know, sort of like how Disney already had its own niche in the American animated market, so Pixar and DreamWorks deliberately went in different directions. Because they knew when we just do movies that try to copy Disney, no one's going to remember them. But if we do other stuff, then we can create our own niches and our own places in people's minds.
Yeah, because I do think like place and this is sort of a more general term, and I did wonder. It made me think of how we can like directors who maybe do some similar things, but also still leave their stamp, their personal stamp on their work, and because I will say. Anytime we get this comparison between directors, it's always something I brace at a little bit. I sort of understand it on one level because it's a shorthand for maybe a director that people are familiar with. You know, if you have no frame of reference for a new director whatsoever, then sure, compare, you know, saying he's the next whatever is, you know, sort of an easy, you know, way entry.
And some people would say a lazy way.
I would say that too. Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
I understand it on one level, but on the other hand, I'm like, well, okay, but we shouldn't just.
And you know, that's why.
It kind of starts. Well, it kind of starts to feel like you're on Amazon and you're just trying to buy a book, and they're like, well, if you like this book, you might also like this one. Or it's like people who buy this, like people who bought this blender also like tends to like this spatula. It's like, okay, but that's not really giving us the information that's useful or interesting, because everybody's coming from filmmaking from a personal perspective. And even if you're inspired by a filmmaker and their work, you're still bringing in so many other elements, including your own personality, that one filmmaker is never going to be 100% like another filmmaker. And you can compare them, but you know, it's important to remember that contrasting is a key aspect of comparison.
Yeah. Plus, like, this whole this whole thing about I guess the other thing is that it sort of erases the identity of that new director. I mean, like,
certainly.
If you stop at the, you know, next whatever.
And it also hangs a lot around their neck. Like, it puts a lot of added pressure.
Right.
Like, they're, this filmmaker that we're talking about today is being compared to maybe the best and definitely one of the most preeminent anime creators who's ever existed. So to be like, oh, he's the next one. It's like, okay. I don't think I would want to have that as what people are talking about me either, because it's like, well, how do you go and create art and be brave and be vulnerable when you have that type of expectation hanging around you?
That's similar to the critique a lot of people have of the new Hollywood trend of, oh, this guy has made one or two really interesting indie films. Let's give him the reins of a $300 million tentpole blockbuster.
Right, like Colin Trevorrow is the new Spielberg because he made one movie starring Audrey Plaza. It's like, wait, what? Like, calm down, guys.
I mean, in general, I'm really not a fan of doing that.
Yeah, I mean, there's, plus, like, and I think this gets back to this whole idea of the place that these films have. It doesn't seem to me that, like, they're really interested in the stories that they're telling seem so different from one another. I mean, I would honestly say someone like Mamoru Hosoda is closer in terms of content to someone like Miyazaki. Hosoda's probably known for doing movies like The Boy and the Beast most recently, which I saw and really enjoyed, as well as Wolf Children and The Girl Who Leapt Through Time.
All on my to-see list.
I mean, like, because I think those have more elements of magical realism that we see in Miyazaki. And while certainly Shinkai has elements of fantasy, I don't know if I'd say there's magical realism in them. I mean, in something like Your Name, there is a supernatural aspect, but it's not really seen as the idea of magical realism that's sort of accepted. And here it's
more,
like,
of a sci-fi concept.
Yeah,
and
than
from
a
what I understand, I think Shinkai's first film is something of a sci-fi film. So in that sense, that would make it a little bit more in line with what he's done in the past.
Yeah. But again, yeah, I guess what I'm saying is I think tonally they're sort of operating on different, not necessarily better or worse levels. But I think also maybe speaks, and something you were saying earlier, Noah, that we said off air was this question of where are these comparisons being made? Are they being made in the Japanese press, or are they being made in more Western outlets? And I don't know if I have a firm
answer. I can very
answer.
Clearly imagine Western audiences who maybe have seen Spirited Away and Howl's Moving Castle and maybe one or two other animated classics out of Japan, seeing this movie and saying, oh, like Miyazaki. It's much easier for me to believe that than for me to believe that a Japanese viewer who would have a much, much broader perspective on animation in general would automatically assume, oh, this new hot animated director like Miyazaki.
Because I did see it in a lot of Western outlets. I don't want to generalize all, you know, movie publications necessarily making this comparison. But one of the reasons why I could see maybe outlets everywhere making that comparison is level of success, because Your Name has been spectacularly successful at the Japanese box office, and sort of, at least from a financial standpoint, merits comparison to the most financially successful Miyazaki films. So that could also be an element of this, in addition to possible content or the fact that they happen to be working in a similar medium.
My impression is that this was like the Titanic of last year in Japan. Like, it was a hugely financially successful film, and it was also tons of merchandise everywhere. Like, hugely penetrated the zeitgeist there,
the
highest grossing
film ever in Japan is Spirited Away, and this is apparently number two.
Right.
So the Titanic
and
slash,
I mean,
Avatar,
you know, what's at the heart of,
not misplaced in terms of the just the size of it.
Well, and also at the heart of Titanic is a love story between two teenagers, so it feels like a pretty apt comparison, a doomed romance.
That's the way to go if you want your movie to make mucho dolores, I guess.
And let me tell you, the teenage girls that I saw this movie with, I didn't go to a screening with teenage girls, to be clear, but they were in attendance as I was also in attendance separately, and they all loved this film and couldn't stop raving about it.
I mean, there's something about the scale that I see Shinkai working on that I am really drawn to. It's does seem a little more intimate in a way. And that's not to say that I think Miyazaki is doing the opposite necessarily. But I do see his works as being more, I do see his works being more fantastical, than what I've seen of Shinkai, in a way that I think is really interesting, because it lets us sort of puts us in the place usually of the main characters of really acclimating to this new fantastic environment. And as the film goes on, we start to learn more of the rules of this world, and start to see the characters adapt and then ourselves adapt to this world. So what appeared to be totally fantastical is sort of brought into more of a real sense. That I think has echoes of the real world in it.
And that's why I think it's much more of a sci-fi film than a magically real film, because it really feels grounded in a very strong reality throughout, and a very recognizable real world. There's just this kind of sci-fi aspect to it, like this device that's happening, that's allowing this unexpected connection. But otherwise,
there's another difference
film.
That just occurred to me, just sort of as we were talking about this, because you were talking about how, you know, you're saying there are a lot of teenagers in the audience and they really loved it. a similar thread, in addition to the idea of, you know, focusing on a couple of characters who are sort of loners and separated from society, Shinkai's work also seems a little bit more teenage oriented, or oriented towards a lot of the issues that go on in, you know, the puberty, high school, teenage years, of searching for identity, whereas Miyazaki has explicitly stated a lot of his movies, especially some of his most iconic ones like Spirited Away, and Ponyo and Totoro, are more clearly, or like Kiki's Delivery Service, like he made them with the idea of, I want, you know, a 7 or 8 or 9 year old to love this movie. And to love these characters. So there is more with a lot of Miyazaki's films. There was either he had in mind like smaller children seeing this movie when he was, you know, in the creative process, or his films are so different, or the films are so different from anything else, like Princess Mononoke or The Wind Rises, that they're de facto more adult movies, because they just have this complexity that doesn't
right.
apply to a particular age group and that only an adult would really be able to follow and grasp. So that's sort of more where Miyazaki's films tend to fall in terms of either the unintentional or the intentional appeal of how they were creating, whereas Shinkai seems to focus more on the many messy aspects of like being a teenager, almost an adult.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that this is definitely a coming-of-age love story. I think that is, like, a coming-of-age romance is how I would define this film before any other descriptor. Do you think that that's a pretty apt description of it, Justin?
Well, I guess it's a question of whether you read... So did you read the relationship between Taki and Mitsuha as romantic?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think, you know, it doesn't start out as romantic, but I think that it eventually develops into a romance. I mean, Think about how the film closes. I won't say how it closes, but think about that scene. That's a very romantic scene. I don't know how you could read it any other way.
Yeah, I guess I saw it. I saw it as very intimate, but... I do think there's a way in which the film to me didn't play explicitly romantic while still showing the profound connection between them.
We also saw slightly different versions of the film, so that could be impacting us here.
But I mean, certainly, I would certainly say certainly Shinkai to me seems more interested in that than Miyazaki does.
Yes.
this romantic aspect, and I think it's more explicit.
I think it's specifically a coming of age romance, mm-hmm. where it's these two people are finding themselves as they find each other, and they know themselves better as they know each other better, and that's a very teenage type of story, and that's something that would be very alienating to like an 8 or 9 year old who's coming into the audience, you know.
Yeah.
I would think, or especially a 5 or 6 year old coming into the audience, you know. So I think in that way it's definitely a clear difference from what you guys are describing Miyazaki as. I mean, now the only Miyazaki film I've seen is The Wind Rises, which is a pretty adult film.
Right.
I can't see a lot of 7 year olds sitting through that and appreciating it in the way that I did.
That's one of the exceptions. But a lot of his other movies, he has gone on the record as saying, you know, well, when I made this movie, my kids were 9 or 10. And I thought to myself, I want this to be a movie my kids will sit down and watch and really enjoy. And that very much shaped his process of thinking about what type of story and world and setting and characters do I want to tell. And that obviously is going to come, that's going to result in a much different product than, oh, I want to deal with, like, you know, what sort of issues do you face when you're in the cusp of adulthood and you feel like a social outcast? And that's just that, just by starting out and saying, that's the kind of thing I want to touch on, that inevitably means you are going to get pretty different products that are going to have different messages and speak to different people and therefore have different places.
We got back to it.
Everything is connected, gentlemen.
But I do... There's something I'm always going to appreciate about Miyazaki doing it usually in an environment where we kind of have to catch up to the characters to figure out what's happening. But I think at the same time still tap into real world... problems and universal sort of concerns about coming of age. Again, using these sort of more fantastical environments and universes really to do that is just, to me, it's just like it's always one of those experiences where you're like, how is this going to relate? And then by the end of the movie, I think Miyazaki usually finds a way to relate it. I don't know if that's the approach that Shinkai prefers. I like you said, Alex, I think he is much more grounded in, you know, in terms of the setting for his movies. But, you know, maybe I think shows sort of the magic of the everyday. And I love the fact that these two approaches exist. And, you know, I think they're different. I think they're different places.
I agree. Like, for instance, so. I found there's a scene where Mitsuha is in Taki's body, and she is a small town girl who has always wanted to go into the city, and she gets to roam Tokyo for the first time, and it's just beautiful. Like, it honestly, it brought tears to my eyes watching someone appreciate a city in the way that the film appreciates the city in that moment. And I kind of compare it to a scene from The Wind Rises where the main character is in a train, and the train is roaming the countryside, and the train kind of feels alive, and it feels like it's almost like this this like animalistic like entity bringing them through this countryside, and everything feels a little bit alive, and it's this heightened reality, and that's meant to express kind of what's beautiful about that landscape and that experience that the characters
have. If that scene stuck out to you, you really need to see My Neighbor Totoro. Because okay. There's a scene there where the kids are are being transported on something that is alive.
Okay. But so I think that it stuck out to me as a point of comparison here, because what the two filmmakers are doing is really trying to express the same kind of wonder about the things that we would take for granted as mundane and as part of our everyday life and find the magic in them. But what Miyazaki did was have them literally come alive in this kind of very emotional, surreal way. Whereas what the filmmaker here did in Your Name was just really grind down into all of the specific minute details of city life and how amazing they can seem from someone who's not used to it. And, you know, I'm someone who really loves this city as a concept as well. I lived in New York City for a few years in college, and I go back there as often as I can. I feel so reinvigorated by the experience of being a part of a city. And I found that moment in the film really kind of captured an emotional reality for me by not heightening the reality, by just exposing what's so beautiful about it in as it exists. So I thought that it seemed to me as a pretty interesting comparison point for how the two directors tackle very similar idea.
And the great moment of when she realizes that they're going to go to a cafe,
yeah.
Which is the biggest deal in the world.
Yes.
And evidently that's true in Japan. So.
Wait, what's true?
They make a whole point of cafes as this almost sort of holy grail of
culture for teenagers, of an urban experience. Which is, you know, I think that's somewhat similar to how teens operate here.
Going
I think
to
that
the
having,
mall.
You know, there's a lot of teens who like to, well,
yeah.
Or coffee shops. I think you see a lot of older teens focused around coffee shops, feeling very sophisticated in doing so.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be this place where it's, like, very nice, where you're maybe supposed to dress up a little, and the food's kind of expensive, but it's very much filtered through her perspective, and I really do like that about the movie.
Yes.
So, all right. Is there any other thoughts that you guys have?
Sadly, no, because I'm still waiting for it to come out in theaters. It is coming out here, though, and I will see it.
Well, and I was surprised, honestly, by how big of a release the film is having in the States.
Yeah.
I was expecting that this was something that I might have to travel into New York City for or just have to wait until it pops up on demand. But it really, you know, it's playing in my local, not even the art house theater, just the kind of secondary market theater where you get a lot of, like, old white lady movies. You know, anything starring Judi Dench is going to show up there. So I was really impressed that it was playing there. And I know I have friends in other parts of the country who were equally as surprised to find that it's playing in their local Cineplex.
I was surprised that, yeah, because like I kind of like you, Alex. So I live in California, so I was expecting it was just going to be in L.A. And then I saw it was playing like 20 minutes away from me in Sacramento. So I was like, oh wow, this is getting a bigger release than I thought, especially considering it didn't get any sort of attention from the Academy. I don't know if that's because maybe it didn't play. I don't actually know if they had a qualifying run for it in theaters for that bid. Is there any other thoughts that you guys had on either these two directors or on or on the film or on Shinkai?
Everyone go see this movie to prove that foreign animated films can make a profit in the States.
Yeah.
I support that.
Yep, that's what I did, and I was glad. I was like, it's so rare when I get to see an anime in a theater nowadays. So it's like, it's always like a rare treat for me.
And this is the type of movie that is worth, like, shelling out
the
money for.
It's definitely worth seeing. This is, like, animated films are worth seeing on the big screen. Like, I cannot stress that enough.
Yeah, whereas I'm deliberately not spending money on seeing the Scarlett Johansson Ghost in the Shell remake.
Well,
you and everyone else in America,
well,
apparently.
I'm not against seeing it at some point in time, but I will not spend money on it. On the other hand, I was elated to find out today, Get Out is going to get a theatrical release here in about a month's time.
Oh, good.
So I can't.
That's good.
I don't have to stream it. I can wait a bit, and then I can spend money on it. So I was extremely pleased.
All right. Well, before we go on another tangent, I think we'll wrap this up.
Now that I've completely broken the topic,
okay.
Broken the magic of the moment.
Let's. I think that'll conclude our discussion. But before we go, let's talk about where we can find everybody these days. So, Noah, why don't we start with you this time? Where can we find you?
Well, as always, I have my film blog at francenoir.blogspot.com. I have a YouTube page that I'm really not using right now, so for up-to-date stuff of what I'm doing, stick to the blog page. And, of course, my Twitter page as well, which we can link, I guess, in the description.
Yeah, we can do that.
Yep.
Yeah, because I saw you're going to be doing a series on films for the Trump age, which I'm really excited about.
let me briefly plug that. So first off, the next big post that I'm almost finished with and is coming out is a look at One Piece, the anime and manga giant, and why, unlike its contemporaries Bleach and Naruto, One Piece is not only still doing very well for itself and is still very popular, but in my opinion has actually been getting better with age, and it's been running for over 20 years now, or almost 20 years, whereas Bleach and Naruto declined for quite a while until they finally concluded in the past couple of years. But other than that, I'm also, as Justin mentioned, I'm planning a semi-regular series for the blog that I will do as long as I have to, called Films for the Trump Years, where I will be... right now my plan is once a month. If I do this more or less frequently will depend on circumstance. But for now, once a month, I'll do a short post on a film or a series of related films that touch on... this will be a mix. Some of these will be fictional. Some of them will be historical dramas or documentaries. But films that touch on ideas or themes or periods in history that I think are... relevant to what we're going through with the rise of Trumpism and right-wing populism today, especially with an especial focus being on historical films that highlight occasions in the past where we've gone through stuff like what we're seeing now, so that we can see how do people we can remind ourselves how did people tackle this then, and what can we take from that now. So I can already say that the first film I'll be doing is going to be Selma, touching on the civil rights movement, the first film by Ava DuVernay. Ava DuVernay's second film, her documentary 13th, which was my number one film from last year, I will definitely be doing at some point. Good Night and Good Luck. I will also be doing pretty soon the black and white film starring George Clooney about McCarthyism. And there are a bunch of others that I have down on a list somewhere. So there's more than enough film out there for me to keep it up as long as I have to. Hopefully I won't have to do it more than a few years, but we'll see. So
that sounds great. Just a point of correction. Ava DuVernay, that was her big breakthrough mainstream film, Selma, but she's made a couple of smaller indies before that, which are, I believe, right. both of it. They're both available on Netflix, nowhere. I believe, so you should check those out.
That is true. Thank you for the correction. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so Alex, where can we find your work?
Well, you can find me always on Twitter at Media Thinkings. That's MediaThinkings. And you can also find me writing about film currently at Letterboxd.com, that social networking site, also under Media Thinkings. I have a long dormant blog that I hope to start up soon, but as of right now, the podcast is all I have time for. I promise I do like film and I do watch films. It just so happens that recently it's not been a particularly great time at the movies, it's been an excellent time on television where filmmakers and film stars are able to do work that they don't get to do anymore on the big screen. So that's why what I've been watching lately's have all been about TV recently. But I promise I do like movies too.
Great. And for myself, you can find me. My website is thecinemaverick.com, which is thecinemaverick.com. I'm also on Letterboxd with the same handle, The Cinemaverick. And you'll probably be seeing a lot of films from last year because I've been there were so many films from last year that I wanted to see, or I was just like, all right, this is what I'm going to focus on. So I've been enjoying doing that. Hopefully soon, I think I talked about it in the last episode, but hopefully soon I'll be posting a retrospective on Terrence Malick, though I may be adding Song to Song if I can see that, as that's his most current film. I don't know if I'm especially looking forward to it, considering I haven't really enjoyed his last two films, but it should be interesting.
Are you weren't a fan of Knight of Cups?
No, I was not. Not at all. It's my least favorite Malick film. All right. So on that note, I guess we'll sign off, and we'll have another episode out soon. So thank you very much for listening, and take care.
Bye.
So long.